Mina motioned to Kathy to follow her as she shouldered her way resolutely through the noisy, bustling crowd toward a different exit. Kathy tagged along behind, struggling to keep up with her. At the curb, Mina pointed at a certain taxi. Its driver, lounging against its scratched front fender, jumped to open the door for the two young women. The cab was crusted with grime and dented in several places, but it was powered by a fuel cell engine, according to the red lettering that was barely visible through the dirt. "Was he waiting for you?" Kathy asked as the cab pulled into the thick, growling, honking traffic. Leaning forward to adjust the air conditioning, Mina answered,
"He knew there was a tour coming in, around this time."
Kathy saw that the driver had done his best to make the interior of the taxi clean and comfortable. The upholstery of the seats was covered with a relatively clean checkered bedspread. A fringe of tiny red tassels ran across the top of the windows. But the floor was tacky. Her loafers stuck slightly to the grime. The cab threaded through traffic-choked streets and out into the somewhat quieter part of the city where Mina's family lived. The driver blared his horn again and again to get through the children playing in the streets. There were hordes of them, Kathy saw. Thin, raggedly clothed, many of them barefoot. But they were laughing as they ran and played their childhood games. "They don't know that they're poor," Kathy realized. Then she saw bands of youths lounging on the street corners, their dark slitted eyes following the taxi as it drove past, and heard her mother's voice in her mind, "Don't go out into those streets under any circumstances." Kathy silently agreed. Mina's home was on the top floor of a three-story cinder block building that housed seven families. Kathy followed her up the stairs, past still more children running up and down or simply sitting on the steps. Several small dogs were frisking along the stairs, too, and Kathy saw one fluffy gray cat slinking between seated children. The walls were covered with graffiti, and the stairwell smelled faintly of urine.
"We have air conditioning," Mina said proudly as they made their way to the top floor. "Most of the solar cells on the roof are broken, but my father keeps ours in good repair."
The apartment was small but clean. A pair of pre-teen-aged boys were playing a video game in the stuffy little parlor, oblivious to everything around them. Mina brought Kathy straight into the spacious kitchen, which was crowded with women. She smilingly introduced Kathy to her mother and five sisters, who ranged from teenaged to toddlers. The teenager had a baby in her arms. The mother looked aged, her parchment-colored skin wrinkled, her dark eyes surly. She spoke to her daughter in Arabic, never dreaming that Kathy could understand her perfectly.
"Another mouth to feed?"
Mina smiled sweetly as she answered,
"She is my friend, and I offered her hospitality." "I hope you can pay for your generosity." "Oh, Mama, don't be cross."
While they quarreled, Kathy looked through the kitchen doorway back into the living room. Two beds stood against the wall, neatly made up. Apparently the whole family lived in these few rooms. The furniture was hard used, the carpeting threadbare. But it was all clean. The kitchen smelled of spices and something that was simmering in a pot on the gas stove. Once Mina had finished her minor spat with her mother, Kathy asked,
"Five sisters? Do you have any brothers?"
"Three,"
Mina answered.
"They work with my father at his repair shop. They'll be home soon."
"Are you the oldest?"
"The oldest daughter. One of my brothers is older than I am."
The mother grudgingly set out a pair of tall glasses and poured tea for them. Mina and Kathy sat at the wooden kitchen table, while the other daughters grouped themselves across the room in a semicircle of unmatched chairs and fell to talking among themselves. Kathy smiled as she accepted her glass of sweetened tea and almost said her thanks in Arabic. She caught herself just in time. Mama trudged across the room and joined her daughters.
"Are you married?"
she asked Mina.
"Not yet. My sister Ismaela got married last year, and she has a baby already."
Mina frowned momentarily.
"That is why she had to get married. Otherwise my father would have had to start a blood feud."
"Blood feud?"
"For the honor of our family. Either that or an honor killing. But my father is too tender to kill his own daughter, even if she brings shame upon us."
Kathy fell speechless. In her mind she heard her mother's bitter voice. "They kill their daughters, but they won't even think of birth control." As if she sensed Kathy's stunned disapproval, Mina changed the subject slightly.
"I will be married next year, after I have saved enough money from my job as a tour guide."
"I see.
And then I will have babies, too. Many babies, you'll see. Is that what you want?"
Mina's eyes widened at the question.
"What I want? Of course it's what I want. What woman doesn't want to be married and have lots of babies?"
Kathy looked from Mina to her mother, old and weary before her time. She can't be more than 50, Kathy thought. 8 children and grandchildren coming along. And they want to live this way. Chapter 6
"The Archbishop has asked me to work directly with him on the Stoner business," Angelique said as she sat before Bishop Craig at his desk. Craig seemed on edge, jittery, his hands fluttering over his desktop, his eyes blinking constantly. Angelique knew that the bishop had always felt secure, confident, when he was seated behind his desk. It's like a protective fortification to him, she thought. But this morning he was uncertain, stressed out, frightened. She repeated, "Archbishop Overmyer has asked me to work with him." Normally, Craig's power-sensitive antennae would have alerted him to a possible danger. Now he merely said, "The Archbishop?" Angelique nodded. It wasn't a lie, she told herself. It was merely an anticipation. She would go to the Archbishop in his hospital room before the morning was over. And by the time she left, he would have indeed asked her to work directly with him. She'd see to that. Instead of being suspicious, Craig seemed resigned.
"That means you'll be leaving my office?"
Angelique put on an unhappy expression.
"I'm afraid I'll have to, Your Worship. Temporarily."
Then she let a tiny hint of a smile appear.
"But isn't it better for you to have a loyal worker inside the Archbishop's staff? Someone who could let you know what the Archbishop is doing, what he's planning, what he's thinking, before anyone else knows?"
Craig leaned back in his swivel chair and stared up at the cream-colored ceiling, his fingers still twitching. At last he said,
"I suppose that could be an advantage."
"The Archbishop is going to be in hospital for a few days," she went on. "He's asked me to run his office as if he's still there. No one but his closest aides will know that he's not. And you, of course."
The bishop stared at her for several moments. At last he sat up straighter in his swivel chair and asked,
"Can you get him to appoint me as his acting archbishop? Strictly on a temporary basis, of course, until he's back on his feet."
Angelique gulped at the man's naked ambition. Terrified of Stoner or not, he still wants the archbishop's ring.
"I'm not sure that would be wise, Your Worship," she said softly. "Not at this moment."
Craig sank back in his chair.
"Probably not. You're right. He wants to keep his incapacity secret."
"It will only be for a few days at most."
The bishop's face showed his thought clearly. "Too bad."
"In the meantime, Your Worship, you will have to deal with the problem of Stoner."
"No! I don't want to be anywhere near him. He's in league with Satan."
Angelique saw the unabashed fear in his eyes. She said,
"The Archbishop doesn't believe so."
"Stoner's got to be stopped."
Feeling some alarm, Angelique replied,
"But if he can help us to prevent nuclear war, isn't that a good thing?"
"What if God wants us to have a nuclear war?" Craig asked. "He sent a flood once, when the human race had turned its face from him. Maybe now he'll send a nuclear war."
"But we haven't turned away from God," Angelique cried. "The new morality has brought the people back to God's way."
His brows knitting, Bishop Craig muttered,
"True, true. But is it enough? Have we made mankind pleasing in the sight of God?"
He ran a hand over his eyes.
"This whole business of Stoner is unsettling."
"Of course, Your Worship," Angelique murmured.
Craig studied her face for a long moment.
"You know, I had a revelation in there. When he showed us the nuclear holocaust, God sent me a revelation."
"A revelation?"
"Yes. The end of the world is truly at hand. It's all part of God's plan, the final act."
Her mind racing, Angelique told herself,
be very careful how you answer him.